Hey, everybody. So we recorded this episode a few weeks ago, prior to the shooting of Jacob Blake. And we just wanted to take a moment at the top of our show to acknowledge what's happening in our country right now and to speak in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement. Our goal in starting this podcast, Lever Talks, was to have a place where we could openly discuss all things hepatology and training, but also felt that it was important that we use our platform, albeit small, to bring further awareness to this important issue.
And we'd love to hear from you regarding topics or suggestions of guests that might be able to speak towards racial disparities within our field. You can get in touch with us at liverfellow@gmail.com. But without further ado, please enjoy episode 2, and we thank you for listening. Hi, Alex.
Hey, Adam.
And hello, everyone.
Hello.
I'm Adam Winters. That other voice you heard was my co-host, Alex Vogel. And this is Liver Talks, the Liver Fellow Network podcast. Alex, what are we going to be doing today?
Thanks for asking. And thanks for coming back, everybody.
Welcome.
We have a great show today. In the first segment, we're going to talk a little bit about the GI fellowship application process, since some percentage of the people that are listening to this presumably are applying to GI fellowship right now, and those that have already applied can just enjoy the process of remembering fondly having survived it. Then in the second segment, we'll be talking to Dr. Arpan Patel, who is a transplant hepatologist in LA, whose research and clinical interest is in palliative care, for a really interesting conversation. Finally, we have the freestyle segment.
And I am very excited for the freestyle segment today.
Yes, you've put me to the task of ranking the top 5 Taylor Swift songs in honor of her most recent album, which is Fire, coming out, Folklore.
And boy, did Alex go down a process for this, and I can't wait to walk everyone through it.
Yeah, you should feel liberated in fast-forwarding to the end to hear that immediately. But let's get started.
Let's get started. So before we get to all that, two things have changed since we last recorded.
Yeah, there are actually 3 things. The first is you are officially off the market, having become engaged since the last episode. So congratulations.
Thank you. That is correct. I have gotten engaged, but that's not... Well, I guess you added one, so that's
fine. I did. Yeah. Second, and significantly more importantly, the two of us became international superstars.
That's right. We may or may not be on an iTunes podcast list that extends down to the millions, but we do thank you all for listening to the first episode.
Yes, thank you.
We really, really appreciate it. And we do have a number of 5-star ratings on iTunes, which was a surprise to both of us. So we appreciate those that took the time to rate and review, as they say, although there are no reviews, but we'll get our parents on that.
Yeah, I think most of the 5-star reviews are from people biologically related to me or soon to be related to me by law.
Yeah, so we thank them for their perseverance through that
process. And what's the third, Adam?
So the third is, and you made reference to it earlier, is that people have applied for GI fellowship.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, how about that?
Mm.
And I know, yeah, so we wanted to spend a few minutes here in segment one just talking a little bit about our experience, which we know is going to be very different from what those of you applying now have experienced, with the lack of in-person interviews and everything that the coronavirus has done to sort of change the interview process. So we know that our experience isn't exactly an apples-to-apples comparison, but we thought maybe it would be helpful if we just kind of talked about it for a little bit. Alex, anything you want to share about maybe your post-application, pre-interview process, anything that you found helpful? Or even going up into the interview process, anything that you found helpful during your time as an applicant?
Yeah, well, I think it is challenging in a way this year just by virtue of it being on Zoom, although we now have 6 months of literally everything being on Zoom. So hopefully everybody's had a chance to sort of acclimate to communication and conveying their opinions and personalities digitally, as we are doing right now. Right. But I think that the advantage is that you can explore programs that you may not have otherwise been able to, and there's potentially the opportunity for more one-to-one and group interactions through different sort of Zoom opportunities that different programs are planning to do.
Yeah, I do think you're a little bit disadvantaged because there are definitely interviews I went on where I walked in and you could feel kind of the vibe was maybe not something that you were looking for. And I think that's, you know, unfortunately a byproduct of, you know, the times that we're in, and you'll kind of lose that ability to get that sense. I think I'm not sure exactly how Zoom is going to translate, but maybe people have become very perceptive on using Zoom. I'm not really sure if you can kind of read the tea leaves like that, interviewing on something.
Yeah, I will say, I think that a lot of the sort of vibe effect that you're describing, I got from speaking one-on-one with different fellows. And so having those opportunities, and I'm sure any program you're interviewing with is happy to set up sort of separate conversations for you with different fellows in an informal capacity to get a sense of what the program is like. Because I do agree that even more so than internal medicine residency, your fit personality-wise is crucial because there's so many fewer of you. And unlike during residency, you're now calling and interacting with attendings and other fellows at 2 a.m. Yes. So having people that are sort of friendly and vibe with you is very important. But I do think people will be able to get that just from having conversations with individual fellows over the course of the interview process.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think the main difference between fellowship and residency is really the closeness with which you work with your attendings and how that kind of team dynamic of, you know, there being residents and interns and an attending, and that kind of hierarchy is no longer there. No. And so it's really important. It's really important that number one, that you kind of become comfortable working on your own, but also important that you feel comfortable with the faculty that you'll be working with, because you will be working with them, I think, at least in my experience, much more closely than I was doing so during residency.
Yeah, it's way more like the relationship you probably had with residents as an intern than it is the relationship you had with people as a resident or intern that were attendings during medicine residency.
Yeah, I think that's a really apt comparison. One of the other things, you know, I found helpful, especially as someone who is coming from the Northeast and was looking to make somewhat of a change,
because we're currently Zooming while you're in LA wearing a tank top with a Peloton in the background. So you've really done it.
Really just inviting the people right into my home. It's a good thing this is an audio medium.
Yeah.
I was definitely looking to make somewhat of a transition and come and was at least interested in coming out west. And obviously I succeeded. One of the pieces of advice I got that I was a little leery of initially that I ended up following, and I think it was beneficial, was, you know, if you're someone who's from, you know, done all their training or, you know, education in a specific area of the country and you're interested in moving somewhere and you have a good reason, or even if you don't, you know, even if you're just, you know, interested in making a change like I was, I think it's okay to let programs know, because places have limited interview slots and they want to make sure that the people that they're offering them to are truly interested in coming to their program, because, you know, it's every interview spot given is one that they, you know, can't use on someone else who may be, you know, a little bit more committed to the area. So I actually emailed different programs in different areas of the country that I thought might be a little hesitant to offer me, because I did everything in New York and Philadelphia. That ended up being a successful strategy for me. And I give that piece of advice to people who ask me for advice, because it worked for me. That's not to say it will work for everyone or that programs will be happy to be hearing from you en masse, but I can only speak from my own experience. And I think it worked out in my favor. Any other tips or comments, Alex, that you have for anyone before we move on to the interview?
I don't want to bore everybody with our descriptions of our programs, although I think we would both say that we love the programs we're in and are happy to talk more at length about that. But yes. I think the larger GI Twitter world has realized that there are real challenges to this year's application process. And so I think people at pretty much every program are really eager and happy to talk about their experiences, their programs, the ins and outs of it. And so as far as our programs, Brigham for me and UCLA for you, we are happy to discuss that offline with our tens of fans.
Yeah, of course.
And so anybody that wants to reach out, please just tweet at us or email us. And we are happy to discuss our experience with the interview trail as well as our programs.
Yeah, exactly. We just wanted to give a few basic thoughts here. But again, like Alex said, if you have more in-depth questions, you can always hit us up on Twitter or email us. And with that, I think we'll move on to the interview with Dr. Arpan Patel.
Good luck, everybody.
Yes, good luck. Welcome back. We're now very pleased to be joined by Dr. Arpan Patel, an assistant professor of medicine at my home base, UCLA's David Geffen School of Medicine, and a staff hepatologist at the West LA VA Medical Center. He has a clinical and research interest in palliative hepatology. Dr. Patel, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, so we wanted to start by just having you tell us a little bit about yourself and the kind of your scope of practice as a hepatologist.
So I'm a... I practice both hepatology at the West Los Angeles VA, so I'm a veteran hepatologist. But I'm most of my time. I'm just kidding, guys. I'm pretty new to this. My second year is being an attending. But what I spend most of my time doing is as a health services researcher. So I study quality of care delivered to patients with cirrhosis and hepatobiliary cancers. But I spend a lot of my time focused on work that involves palliative care and end-of-life care for patients with cirrhosis. So that's what I spend most of my time.
And then what initially drew you to the field of hepatology? Were you always kind of liver avid, or was there something that kind of caught your interest during your training?
I would say I always have been pretty liver avid. I had really strong mentors in medical school that I thought, I was always under the impression that that physicians who treated liver disease or the hepatologists I was exposed to were some of the smartest people I knew. They just took really good care of their patients. There really wasn't a question that you could ask them that they didn't know the answer to. And I think that laid a big impression on me because I just thought, these were these like superhero doctors that you could really ask any question to, and then they could also do procedures, which is pretty cool. So I kind of like really took that to stride and, you know, throughout training, just really thought I wanted to be a doctor.
And at what point did you start to feel that you yourself were a superhero as well?
I'm still getting there, Alex.
Okay. So it's not immediately upon becoming attending? Yes. It's disappointing.
Still waiting for the bite from the radioactive.
Yeah. You know, all of our origin stories still take some time to explore, I guess.
Understood.
Yeah. Well, we brought you on because we wanted to discuss the care of liver patients and specifically the intersection of hepatology and palliative care. And I wanted to start by discussing the urgent transplant evaluation or the patient presenting for an urgent transplant evaluation, because I think either fortunately or unfortunately, it's where a lot of trainees at academic centers enter the picture in terms of care for patients with liver disease. We see a lot of patients that we're a high volume transplant center. So we see a lot of patients who are presenting with late stage disease who ultimately are not deemed candidates for liver transplantation and are treated medically either with or without the continued presence of liver specialty care. And I just want to get a sense of what you thought the role of hepatologists are in supporting patients with advanced liver disease through serious illness when there's, you know, a high chance that they may die either during that admission or shortly or upon leaving the hospital.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think that in the same way that many of us get exposed to end-of-life care in residency, that's kind of what first led me to get really interested in this area, because I kind of saw this real consistent narrative of patients coming in and us, you know, really donning that cap as like a superhero. Like, you know, we would come in, do this evaluation, and then make this really impactful life decision for a patient, in many cases, which meant if they lived or died. And I remember distinctly remembering that the days where you had a patient getting transplanted were like the best days of residency, where you really had these like really win moments. But what I also kind of found was that when you didn't have a patient get quite there, it felt like this supreme failure. And I remember really closely having an example of this where I felt, you know, when a patient didn't get to a transplant that, you know, that this was a personal failure of mine. But I also noticed was that a lot of people on the medical team starting to abandon the rest of their care. You know, there were slowly people peeling away, everyone kind of getting less involved. And it was almost coming to the point where there was really just a few people on the team and really there wasn't a lot of people making decisions. And then we had this sort of awkward transition where we would either decide that we were going to discharge a patient or get a palliative care team involved. And there was these new people getting involved. And I sort of kind of had to restructure myself into thinking that why can't we feel like we're just the success, why can't the success be just helping patients achieve good control over their death? You know, why can't we feel that having that level of security and having patients and families control the last few moments of their death, why can't we think of that as a win? And that really is what made me get interested in the field. And really, like my first few research, you know, interests and first few publications were really focused on understanding how patients die and what they experience when they die. And I think that's kind of made me feel like we have to start thinking about our wins.
How do you think our field kind of needs to evolve to feel like that's a win? Because I think personally, when you bring that up, you know, I've never felt, you know, the way, you know, that taking care of a patient through to their death is a win. And, you know, if a patient was really satisfied or a family was really satisfied with the care that they were being delivered, you know, I've personally never felt that way. Is that a shift that needs to be done, you know, broadly, or how do you start introducing that concept to transplant hepatology as a field?
I think the part of it is that we have to believe that first, that, you know, it shouldn't be considered a failure for a patient to die. I think we just have to fundamentally realize there aren't enough livers on the planet and not enough, there aren't enough people who can survive a transplant. So fundamentally, we just have to believe that not everyone's going to get a transplant. But I think that once we believe that, we can start helping our patients believe that. So I do feel like we have to think that first before getting our patients to do that. And I think when you frame it to patients, I when I treat veterans, like I think a lot of them are not transplant candidates, so I get a lot of experience doing this. And I think that when you frame it to people early, you know, especially the ones that you don't think are going to make it to transplant, they start believing it too, versus framing it to them late. Because when you frame it to people late, they start thinking that you have sort of, you're pulling something under them. And, you know, you're sort of in this space where you sort of dangled a carrot, now you're taking it away. But I think if you sort of present this case of uncertainty in a way that it can go either way and you're planning for one outcome and planning for another outcome, it really makes the most sense.
Do you have any sort of tips in terms of how to have that, even if it's just a priming conversation with patients? I think on our side, there are a lot of numbers that we know that make it very clear that things may not turn out well. You know, mortality rates of well over 50% during index hospitalizations, even things that we think of as a little more benign, like an SBP, that 50% of people with SBP probably aren't alive at a year. Are you using sort of statistics and numbers with them, or are there different ways that you sort of have those conversations?
So I think, I would say that I think what you're talking about is how to deliver prognosis. And so, like, I think that what the people who do a really great job of this, obviously, many of the ways of doing this come from palliative care and their specialty. I like using a way of framing prognosis that's been explored in the surgical literature, and it's called best case, worst case, most likely. So I think the idea behind it is really just, first of all, realizing that most patients don't understand numbers the way we do. So giving them any sort of numbers is in many ways, you have to almost unpack more. I think it depends on your sort of learning ability. Some patients really enjoy numbers, some people don't, but really presenting it in narratives that make a lot of sense to people. So, you know, saying that this is kind of what can happen. The best case is that, you know, you can overcome this infection and get to transplant. And I think people can understand that. And the worst case is, you know, that you won't be able to even overcome this infection and might not leave the hospital. But the most likely case is that you'll overcome the infection, but likely get rehospitalized. So I think when you like say it like that, instead of using numbers, people kind of get a sense of what sort of things they might expect. And I've really used this. I've taken some communication coursework, which has been really helpful, I think, for me, and read a lot about this. And I think that that's a framework that I've always believed has worked for the patients that I've used that on, almost consistently.
And are these things that you're doing kind of upon first meeting the patient? Like, let's say you have a hospitalized patient who you think is a borderline candidate, or even let's say they're a good candidate for liver transplantation, but, you know, obviously there are no slam dunks, right? There's no perfect candidate. You know, are these the lines of communication that you start upon initially meeting the patient and sort of go down all the different avenues, or is this something that you do as the admission unfolds and evolves?
So I think I always base it on how much they know about what's going on, because you can't get into these really crazy sort of hypotheticals without sort of developing a sort of shared understanding. So, you know, I think being a good physician and taking care of patients is just really assessing what they understand at that point and going from there. So if they're not even getting to the point that they have cirrhosis, then you really can't have a lot more conversation. And I think I always also make sure that unless it's imminent, really giving them the space to digest that information. So the first day, even if they have like a MELD of 30, if they're not going to, even MELD of 30 is not a great example, maybe like a MELD of 20 or like less than that. If they're not imminently dying, I don't think that we need to go through all those things the first day, but maybe just talk about cirrhosis and liver disease, and then maybe revisit it the next day. Because it takes a long time for people to process things, as well as also sharing it with their family members and helping them process things. So especially in like the inpatient setting, things are super, you know, condensed. You're taking like a lot of information that people hear over several months and years and putting it down to like a day or two, it's going to be really hard to digest. Mm-hmm. And so I basically try to adapt it to how much they know and go from there.
Especially for patients who are coming in, maybe who'd never had liver disease before and they have like, you know, severe alcoholic hepatitis and they're just learning about liver disease for the first time, and trying to sort of drop all of that information on them at once is probably extremely challenging.
You'd even be surprised that in my experience, at least, even some people who have been on medications don't have no idea that the medications are like how that relates to their liver disease. They could be like on lactulose and rifaximin and realize that these aren't really reversing your liver disease. They're just treating the problem. So I think when people start to put some of those things together, like realize that the Lasix and spironolactone is just treating a symptom of a big problem, which is that you need a new liver rather than curing your liver disease. I think even helping them understand those things is really important.
And I wonder what you think about the importance of fellows as kind of the arbiters of these conversations as well, because I imagine there are a lot of established transplant hepatologists who, you know, haven't really been involved in the kind of palliative conversations that you're talking about, and how, you know, important it is to kind of breed a new generation of hepatologists who are interested in this topic and who are comfortable having these conversations, because, you know, there's a lot that needs to be done when these patients come into the hospital from just a transplant evaluation standpoint. And I think oftentimes it falls to trainees to be the ones who are delivering this news and having these difficult conversations.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think that the model of, in general, communication has been that you sort of see one, do one, teach one. And I think that, you know, one thing that a lot of palliative care, you know, specialists have said, and I really truly believe this, is that you have to treat communication like a procedure, just like an endoscopy. You know, it's something that you get proficient in, and no one's expecting you to do that well the first time. So I think that just like endoscopy, you know, everyone has different learning styles. You have to kind of get a sense of where people are when they initially start and go from there. So at least my approach has been, you know, and I'm in a different sort of practicing environment than a lot of hepatologists, but I actually do all the goals of care conversations with my patients in the hospital when they are hospitalized. And I do try to get the fellows involved, but I don't necessarily expect them to go through the whole conversation and really get a sense of where they're at. I think it's hard, though. I think there are challenges of teaching this in when it's not necessarily a valued skill in subspecialty fields. And I think that there has to be some culture change around making sure it is, particularly those who are interested in liver disease. So I can sit here and say, like, you know, these are things that all fellows should do. But I think that it has to kind of come from top down to make sure it's a skill that gets perpetuated. I would hope that for those who are interested in liver disease, particularly or treating cirrhosis patients, that they can at least start, I hope that they can start to take an active interest in doing.
And I imagine that when you're having these conversations with patients and families, there's a lot of miscommunication and misunderstanding on perhaps on both sides. Any tips or pearls you have for providers who are, you know, having these sorts of conversations with patients, or any pitfalls to avoid that have come up in your practice?
I think you probably alluded to this in your question. It's really just making sure when you're giving bad news that you have all the people in the room or on the phone, because there's a lot of chance. And it, you know, I would say that it's interesting in liver disease because it could be that every day you're delivering bad news, right? You're delivering that the kidney renal failure is worse. You're saying the patient went to the ICU. It can almost be like constantly a sense of delivering bad news. But I think when those things are happening, you just have to make sure that you're updating the family at the same time, or you're giving the news with the family, because you want to make sure they're all on the same page. I think that in high acuity environments, we get sort of used to this idea that, you know, everything is happening so quickly, we just have to make a decision. But when we step back for a second and think, like, is this the care we would really want for our family members? We would probably think very differently about it. And I do think there just has to be a little bit more attention to specific times when the patients are getting sick versus those that are less sick, and really triaging how we can incorporate families in those decisions.
So I wanted to scale it back to the cohort of end-stage liver disease patients, or patients with stable cirrhosis who are established in a subspecialty clinic. Groups probably a little bit more simplified in terms of amount of lead time you have to worsening disease. What's your approach to, you know, advanced care planning in this population? And what do you think are important interventions that hepatologists who care for these patients should be performing, if any?
Yeah, I think that, you know, with patients who are stable, there are opportunities for advanced care planning that are probably less urgent. You know, you want to, I think at the end of the day, it's still for us as specialists, we should spend most of our attention on educating patients on their disease and understanding what support they need. If they're drinking, you know, and they really have alcohol use disorder, I think you have to spend most of your energy in a particular visit addressing that rather than talk about advanced care planning, I think. But once they really get to a set of stability and you're really at a place that we can start having these discussions, I think you could, you know, I'm a big proponent of advanced directives and at least ensuring that every patient with cirrhosis has an advanced directive. So I bring up that conversation when things have calmed down and you're not, and you have a chance to really just limit it down to the bare essentials in that visit. But I think from a practical standpoint, there are so many things that you want to talk about, you know, even with regards to HCC screening, variceal screening, and all those things. But I usually mention it when things are completely stable. And I think there are opportunities to talk about best case and worst case.
Do you ever refer patients to palliative care, or are you pretty much doing all that kind of care yourself?
So I think that what I like to think is, you know, when I'm running out of support to have these conversations is when, and also I'm dealing with pretty complex pain management are the times, and also caregiver burden are the times when I refer to palliative care. I really think of them as just like really another layer of support. You know, when you really need, I have so many patients in the VA who live far from our medical center, and they don't have a lot of support. And, you know, it makes it a challenge taking care of them. And I think that even having someone who's a consistent presence for them and their caregivers is really important. And they have such an amazing team, typically with social workers, chaplains, nurses and physicians, that they really offer a full range of support that I think we can't provide ourselves. So I really do it when I think that I'm coming to my limits of how to support them, really. And I can tell you, for patients who, you know, we're really pedal to the metal for transplant, I still get them involved, and they do amazing things in coordinating things for patients. They're amazing care coordinators if you don't have the resources of a huge transplant center. So I've really respected them, because they sort of think of patients as more than getting a transplant. Think of it as, you know, making sure that the seriously ill patient gets the care that they want. And I really like that model.
Do you ever have difficulty broaching that subject with patients, that you're referring them to palliative care, or are they mostly just willing to sort of listen to, you know, the idea that they're going to help, you know, sort of help in the continuation of their care?
So it depends on what care, what setting you're talking about. If you really talk to, and I've done, you know, some qualitative interviews on this in outpatients, if you're going to talk to patients about palliative care, bring it up in the inpatient setting, right when they're getting sick, there's almost no other way they can interpret that as meaning like that they're going to die right now. You know, like there's really like, it's all about when you present the option, I think, in my opinion, like, and how you present it. If for my outpatients who have cirrhosis, who are dealing with like a change, like a new diagnosis of cancer, or, you know, a new issue, I just call them an extra layer of support. And I say it's a team of doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and social workers and chaplains are really there to provide more support as you go through as you go through the next months, because it's going to be a rocky course, and we want to give you all the support that you need. And they really like that.
At its heart, palliative care is all about sort of symptom management instead of necessarily targeting something else. And as you sort of alluded to earlier, in many ways, the management of patients with cirrhosis and some degree of decompensation is also symptom management, whether it's managing their encephalopathy or managing their ascites such that they're more comfortable and have less distension. And while I don't think we're necessarily advocating to referring to palliative care for those specific symptoms, is there any sort of tools or things from palliative care literature that you've sort of taken and applied to the symptom-based care of our patients with chronic liver disease?
So I think that there's a good amount of literature suggesting that now, like a systematic review that came out a few years ago, shows that a lot of symptoms that they experience are probably a lot broader than what we typically think of, you know, not just like ascites, but like nausea and like pruritus and like fatigue and, you know, exhaustion. And they really have a lot of mental health issues too, like anxiety and depression. So I think part of it is that we do know how to treat a lot of physical symptoms, but we're probably not doing a comprehensive assessment the same way that palliative care teams do. Do I do a comprehensive physical assessment in every patient? I can't tell you that I do. And I think that's part of what I'm interested in from my research, is how to integrate some of these things and to make it easier. There aren't any current tools to perform comprehensive physical assessments, physical symptom assessments in patients with end-stage liver disease, but I think that's definitely an area of opportunity. I think lower hanging fruit is finding out resources and methods of screening and also treating patients with mental health issues. I think we just have to be more aware of that and recognize there's this complex overlay with substance use. And so if you're able to do that at the bare minimum, really, and refer them, I think you're really doing, I think, a lot more than what we've typically done for patients.
So with the understanding that this is a relatively fledgling field in the realm of hepatology, what do you think is the most vital clinical research question that remains unanswered, you know, with respect to palliative care and hepatology?
Ooh, that's a loaded question.
Andy, cut out your legs right at the beginning of it.
Fledgling is not a negative, connotation. It just means emerging.
I think so. I mean, you know, listen, like I started doing research in this 5 years ago. Like I would say the number of times that I said I was interested in palliative care and liver disease, like people were just like, well, you want to just be a grim reaper for these patients. So, I mean, just the idea that this is entertained in a conversation of something more than end of life care is really special and kind of is close to me. And I think that that's something that I take a lot away from when I think of how much we've even changed the way we've thought about palliative care. That being said, I think most, for me at least, I think we just have, we have to think about we have to think about the biggest, if we had to think about the biggest issues, I think still end-of-life care is something we have to improve a lot on. But, you know, I've had conversations with many other colleagues in my field recently, and what I've come to realize is that our patients just need a lot of support. And I think that we just, outside of maybe not even, I think outside of transplant centers, I don't think they get a lot of support. And I think that it may have to do with sort of health disparities as is, like they're socioeconomic and, you know, related to race, ethnicity, and geography, and certain things that we can't necessarily fix easily. But I think we just have to have a growing recognition. This is a population in severe need. And we have to understand why. Sometimes it comes to even down to the fact that, like, many of our patients may not even understand what medications they're taking. And being able to modify those proximal experiences might reduce how many of these experiences we're getting into at the end of life. Because at the end of life, if you haven't dealt with educational issues, if you haven't dealt with their emotional issues, you're really dealing with it all at the very end. And so end of life care becomes very complex when you have sort of perpetuated these issues through their illness trajectory. And so I think if we can change end of life care, that's great. If we can change some of these proximal issues, that could also be great.
So it's time for the lightning round. Dr. Patel.
My blood pressure went up just a little bit, by the way.
as it should.
Yes. Yes. These are very, very probing questions. So question one. What is your favorite liver cell?
Ooh, stellate cell.
Okay.
Great. If Dr. Friedman's listening, I'm sure he's thrilled.
Yeah, he got very excited.
that was a shout out to him, actually.
Indoctrinated from his time at Mount Sinai, no doubt.
Yeah, as we all have been. Yeah. All right, question two. When did you last perform a colonoscopy?
My last colon was months ago, but that's because that's more because I'm a researcher, not because I'm a hepatologist. So I'll just put it that way. But I would say it was probably in May. Mm-hmm.
Okay. It was a while. And did you get out of the sigmoid?
I did.
Okay.
I helped a fellow get out of the sigmoid. So.
All right.
Or what's the last show or movie you watched or book that you read?
Oh, the book.
You get to pick one.
So the book that I'm reading right now is Puzzle People by Tom Starzl. And I swear I didn't just say that because, you know,
very topical.
But that was a very hepatologist.
Well, too bad you are a nerd.
I got it as a gift from my program director. One of my hepatology attendings and fellowship just never got around to it.
Awesome. Vogel, you want to go?
Oh, I'm up. Okay, yeah. I think this is particularly helpful for all the trainees listening, probably less so for my parents that are probably also listening. But can you identify a time in your career in which luck played a prominent role?
Wow. Hmm. I would say that's a really hard one.
That's right.
I feel really lucky to have been, this is a really cheesy answer, by the way, you can cut it out if you'd like, but I feel really lucky.
Keep it in.
I feel really lucky to have gone to fellowship at UCLA because I was able I was so lucky to switch from a clinical track to a research track. Because really out of the concern that I was so interested in palliative care research. So I was able to really just switch and pursue a PhD. And even though that sounds like a crazy track that a masochist would take, it's really made, it's really opened my eyes to a lot of things, and allowed me to really embark on this change. So I really thank my program, especially Dr. Lin Chang, shout out to her for really.
She's a listener, by the way. So we're definitely keeping this part in.
Okay. So shout out to her because, you know, I think you just need some of those advocates to really help move your career.
All right. And then any final thoughts or advice you have for fellows and residents who are tuning into the podcast?
Just keep doing what you're doing. If you're tuning into this podcast, it means that you care. So I think that if you care and you're trying to achieve something good every day and learn something new every day, you're ahead of most people. So congrats to that.
It also means that you have excellent tastes. And we thank you.
That's right.
Or just entirely too much time on your hands.
All right. Well, Dr. Patel, thank you so much for joining us and sharing some of your wisdom on palliative care and hepatology. Thanks for helping us out.
The pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much.
The pleasure was all.
All right.
And stay tuned, because in the freestyle section, you will hear my top five Taylor Swift songs.
Well, I am very excited for the freestyle segment today.
And I'm very nervous.
Because, and I'll set this up really quick. We were trying to decide what we were going to do for this segment. Mm-hmm. I had mentioned how much I enjoyed Taylor Swift's new album, Folklore. And somehow we landed on Alex doing his top five Taylor Swift songs for this segment. I think because he's a pretty devout T-Swift fan. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think the idea came out of your desire to make sure that I could never have a career in transplant hepatology or show my face in my own family.
That's true. This is all subterfuge. But anyway, I got an email yesterday because I wanted to know what the top five songs were going to be, which is long. If this was a newspaper, you know, we'd be talking about a significant number of inches of copy here. But I could tell that a great deal of work went into this. And, you know, I was going to explain the process, but I'm actually, Alex, I'm going to have you explain your process for how you whittled this down.
Thank you. And thank you for this challenge. It was
Oh, can you tell that we're not first-year fellows anymore, by the way?
I know, yeah. Instead of doing 8 consult notes yesterday, I just listened to all 8 of Taylor Swift's albums and broke down all the songs. But so I will start by saying that this process of internal reflection as well as reflection on Taylor Swift's career was something. And, you know, if you think into like your fellowship group, there's probably the person who publishes like once a year or once every 2 years, but it's like a pretty solid paper. And then there's like the one person in your group who somehow has 30 to 40 first author abstracts for DDW every year and then has like 10 to 15 manuscripts every year. So Taylor Swift's neither of those people, because she would be the second person if every single one of her manuscripts was exclusively accepted to like the New England Journal or hepatology or gastroenterology.
You really landed the plane there. I wasn't sure where that was going for the longest time.
Yeah. Prolific career, but full of just hits. It was excruciating to come up with the top five, given what I just described about how many
this
good
was
songs
a pained,
she has.
A pained email. I could feel. I was stressed reading it.
Yeah. All right. So you want to run through the honorable mentions?
Yeah. So I'm gonna run through the ones that didn't quite make the cut.
Yeah.
The first one was Wildest Dreams.
Probably the hardest omission.
Yeah. The next was We Are Never Getting Back Together.
Yep.
I Knew You Were Trouble.
Taylor Swift's experimentation with dubstep. So yeah. worth thinking about.
Alex was not feeling 22 because it is on the honorable mention list.
Yeah, it was close between that and Red, but here we are.
And the last one is Blank Space.
Blank Space, and I actually added another one, which was I Don't Want to Live Forever, which was from the 50 Shades Darker soundtrack. Technically not on any of her albums, so we omitted
bit
it.
A deeper cut.
But yeah. It was a good one as well.
Okay. All right, so let's run through the top five.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so number five comes in with Mean.
Mm-hmm.
This is from Speak Now.
Yeah, just a super solid song. Also more of her sort of country roots. It's the main one on this top five that's more from the country domain of hers.
Number four is Red from Red.
Red's a great song. It lyrically is just lovely and sort of communicates her emotions through color, which is nice.
All right, number three, it was Style.
Just a beat that gets stuck in your head. It's a good one. Probably the one that reminds me the most of you.
Oh, thank you. Is this the one where she's driving, the music video, she's like driving in the car?
With some handsome guy in like a leather jacket?
Yeah,
that's actually every single one of her music videos at one point or another, but we'll go with yes for that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Number two was You Belong With Me.
You Belong With Me Incredible song, and I think pound for pound, probably her best music video, for what it's worth. Also took me a number of listens for like the deep cut T-Swift fans on the podcast, which I think is likely zero, with the exception of me. It took me a number of listens to realize that she is both of the main characters in the music video.
You know what? I disagree with that. If you're listening to this podcast and you're a big Taylor Swift fan, hit one of us up on Twitter,
yeah,
or
please.
The Liver Fellow Network podcast up on Twitter. Let us know that you're interested in listening. Okay, so you, Alex Vogel's number one Taylor Swift song.
By a mile.
So this is not even like a cool. Was this the first one you wrote down? Like you knew this was going to be number one?
Yeah. It may just be the number one overall song.
Okay. It is off the album Fearless.
Yep.
And it is Love Story.
Yeah, pretty much the perfect song. It's got it all. It's got a story that it tells. The bridge is dynamite. It's got a mixture of pop and country, and is just, it's a magnificent song through and through. I have nothing to say besides the fact that this is clearly her best song and a national treasure.
Well, there you have it. It is a great song. We made it. We got through the top five.
Yes. I would love to hear anybody's thoughts. Feel free to reach out.
I would too. I would just love to know that someone has thoughts.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And if you have thoughts as to what you would like our next freestyle round to be about, please let us know. Otherwise, please. As mentioned at the top, Adam is newly engaged. My wedding is less than 2 months away, so we may just turn the freestyle segment into a wedding planning self-help pod. I was tangentially related to the planning of my own wedding, so feel that I can at least advise Adam on his upcoming journey.
Yeah, I just started. I feel like we're still in the shire kind of planning our journey here. Want to take us out?
Sure. Well, thank you all for listening. If you haven't already, please smash the subscribe button on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever else you get your podcasts. We'll be here about once every month. If you have any feedback, please reach out to us via Twitter. Please check out all the great content on liverfellow.org from the Liver Fellow Network. And thank you, Arpan Patel, for bravely being our second guest, and all of you for bravely listening.
Thanks, everyone. See you next time.
Bye, Adam.